Many experts believe we have to make significant strides in becoming a carbon neutral planet by 2030 if we want to reverse the impacts of climate change. This podcast exists to help everyday people reduce their carbon footprint in a practical way and become a part of the solution. It's time to rise up and join the carbon neutral movement. This is the Carbon Neutral Podcast. Hello and welcome back to the Carbon Neutral Podcast. In today's episode, we'll be talking about carbon capture technology. What is it? Why was it created? And is it a feasible solution? As always, we'll start off the show by talking about what has happened in the news this week. And first, we'll revisit a topic from last week's segment on Elon Musk's announcement to fund a carbon capture technology with $100 million. He mentioned that he would release more details this week, but unfortunately, we don't have anything new to report regarding Elon Musk's carbon capture contest details. However, there was a lot of buzz around Tesla's new Model S Plaid Edition. If you haven't already seen it, they came out with a new Model S Edition that has a new interior look and feel. And if you want to really get the specs, I'd highly recommend going over to their website. Something very special, though, for those that like quick acceleration is the fact that it's now the fastest car in production, and it can go 60 miles an hour with as little as 1.99 seconds and can go a quarter mile in only 9.3 seconds. The Model S and Tesla as a whole continues to pave the way as far as electric vehicles go. That said, I want to keep it moving, but let's kind of keep it focused around electric transportation. GM announced this week that they'll only be selling zero-emission vehicles by 2035, which is a part of the broader plan to become a carbon-neutral company by 2040. And New York Times covered this announcement and mentioned that it's likely to put pressure on automakers around the world to make similar commitments. It could also embolden President Biden and other elected officials to push for even more aggressive policies to help fight climate change. They go on in the article and talk about the rapid shift by the auto industry could lead to the job losses and business failures in related areas. Electric cars don't have transmissions or a need for oil changes, meaning conventional service stations will basically have to retool what they're doing today. And this is putting traditional manufacturing jobs at risk. But at the same time, the move to electric cars will spark a boom in areas like battery manufacturing, mining, and charging stations. I want to get back to this topic of job losses slash job replacements here in a minute, because I think that this is an important subject. But I have one other story that I want to talk about that's around electric transportation. Neptune Scooters, a shared electric scooter company based in Northern California, may have just solved the problem that its competitors have yet to fix, which is at its core problem, a safety issue. Now, on a side note, I mentioned that I'm getting an e-bike for Portland in the last episode. It's technically an e-scooter that has a seat, and I've been looking at all sorts of e-scooters out there over the last month just because I want to really get to understand the space, and I find it very interesting. One of the main issues that I have with some of these ride-sharing scooters is that they aren't very safe, and this is both an issue for the rider and the local city, which is why so many of these cities have banned these scooters. However, I do believe that there is a fair argument that these can be a means for transportation and a convenient way to get around to get groceries. Now, I found one company, Wheels, you can find them at takewheels.com, that also provides a scooter that has a seat that is also a shared scooter supplier that provides a helmet, which is a huge safety measure and definitely a step in the right direction for personal safety. So basically, when you rent this scooter, once the ride has been paid for, it pops up the helmet and then you can take it. So that's great for the personal safety. But where I think Neptune is unique and it's innovative in their approach is their ability to store these scooters, and it could appease local governments in cities that are skeptical to either introduce or reintroduce this program into their city. But even cities that have an active program may see this as a better option or a better approach overall. Without a visual, it is a little difficult to explain what they created, so I'm going to link the article in the show notes for you. Now, Clean Technica wrote this article, and they open it up by saying one of the biggest challenges for scooter companies so far has been getting along with municipal governments. Stray scooters, sometimes in unsightly piles or dangerously underfoot, low batteries, vandalism, and other problems make for governments to want to avoid this situation altogether by banning shared scooters from the sidewalks. That's where Neptune Scooters wants to be better. They go on to say, to address these challenges without taking up too much space on sidewalks, the company developed a modular multi-dock system that's long and skinny. It's 35 feet long and it's only 2 feet wide. And this takes up about 5 times less space than bike shared docks. The setup is expandable with rails, allowing it to be made longer if needed in a busy area. When the rider's finished with their ride, the software will automatically bill you at the end of the ride and basically bills it once it's been pushed into the dock. That way it's securely locked up and it starts charging again, and even it gets a sanitation with a UV light, which is really cool. It's really, truly remarkable. Now, in the article, it does show you how the multi-dock works, but it's basically like a vending machine for e-scooters. And just to be clear, the ride isn't over until the scooter is docked, which is why it's such a great solution for cities concerned about these scooters just sort of laying around on their sidewalks, or worse, in the roads. And I could talk about e-scooters forever, but I want to get back to the job losses and job replacements, as I mentioned earlier, by talking about what President Biden has been up to this week. So first off, President Biden canceled fossil fuel subsidies. In an article by Clean Technica, they mentioned that if humanity is trying to find a rational and reasonable answer to the challenge of a warming planet, we must stop making the burning of oil, natural gas, and coal the basis of our economy. Giving fossil fuel companies government incentives to extract more oil, gas, and coal is inconsistent with that goal. So you're probably wondering, what is a fossil fuel subsidy? According to the Environmental and Energy Study Institute, the United States provides a number of tax subsidies to the fossil fuel industry as a means of encouraging domestic energy production. These include both direct subsidies to corporations as well as other tax benefits to the fossil fuel industry. Conservative estimates put U.S. direct subsidies to the fossil fuel industry at around $20 billion per year, with 20% currently allocated to coal and 80% to natural gas and crude oil. European Union subsidies are estimated a total of 55 billion euros annually. Historically, subsidies granted to the fossil fuel industry were designed to lower the cost of fossil fuel production and incentivize new domestic energy sources. Today, U.S. taxpayer dollars continue to fund many fossil fuel subsidies that are outdated but remain embedded within the tax code. At a time when renewable energy technology is increasingly cost competitive with fossil fuel generation, and a coordinated strategy must be developed to mitigate climate change, the broader utility of fossil fuel subsidies is being questioned. So what effects do these subsidies have? Well, according to a recent analysis published in Nature Energy, continuing current fossil fuel subsidies would make it profitable to extract half of all domestic oil reserves. That could increase to U.S. oil production by 17 billion barrels over the next few decades and emit an additional 6 billion tons of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. Since lowering the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is critical to limiting global heating, the use of tax dollars to encourage more emissions seems like the wrong-headed policy. Additionally, Biden announced that a new White House office known as the White House Office of Domestic Climate Change Policy is going to be opening this week. Now, in an article published by the White House, the opening statement says, "Today, President Biden will be taking executive action to tackle climate crisis at home and abroad while creating good-paying union jobs, an equitable clean energy future, building modern and sustainable infrastructure, restoring scientific integrity and evidence-based policymaking across the federal government, and reestablishing the President's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology." And one of the key points in the article is titled, "Taking a Whole Government Approach to the Climate Crisis." And there's a couple of bullet points that I wanted to read in this section. The order formally establishes the White House Office of Domestic Climate Policy, led by the first ever National Climate Advisor and Deputy National Climate Advisor, creating a central office in the White House that's charged with coordinating and implementing the President's domestic climate agenda. The order also establishes the National Climate Task Force, which is assembling leaders from across 21 federal agencies and departments to enable a whole government approach in order to combat climate change. And it will be interesting to see what this new office is going to be focused on going forward. So we'll probably have some articles to cover in the next few weeks, hopefully, if not the next few months. In other news, Australia has become the center of climate attention. And according to analytics, 6% of our listeners are based in Australia, so thanks for tuning in. The Guardian wrote on this topic several times this week. One of the articles talked about what Biden's sweeping climate plan means for Prime Minister of Australia, Scott Morrison. The article goes into comparison on how both are handling the climate change issues. Biden is tackling them head on, as the article mentions, whereas the Morrison administration won't even call it by its name. From the article, it says that Martine Wilder, a former chair of the Australian Renewable Energy Agency and founding partner of the climate advisory firm Pollination, says that he believes that Biden's plan is the most comprehensive plan by any government ever on climate change. And people are yet to fully grasp its significance, particularly in terms of national security and foreign policy. However, in contrast, Scott Morrison has said it will not increase what is widely seen as an unambitious 2030 emissions target of 26-28% cut by 2005 levels this year. The government has pulled out of its global climate fund, and it continues to resist mid-century net zero emissions targets despite being backed by more than 120 countries collectively, and it's responsible for about 3/4 of the global GDP. Here's the main issue, however. Australia will effectively be abandoning the Paris Agreement unless it makes at least 50% cuts into the greenhouse gas emissions by 2030, and it reaches its net zero well before 2050, according to an analysis by policymakers and scientists. A report by the new group calling itself the Climate Targets Panel found that the Morrison government should be setting this 2030 emissions reduction by 50% and 74% if Australia was to comply with the goals of limiting global heating to 2 Celsius and 1.5 degrees Celsius, respectively. And just for more background, this comes off an embarrassing moment for the Prime Minister Morrison at the end of 2020. In an article by Renew Economy, they talk more about the rising pressure that he's facing. Scott Morrison ended 2020 notably isolated on climate change, having been embarrassed by the British and French governments rejecting his push to be given a speaking slot at a Global Leaders Climate Ambition Summit. The Prime Minister appeared surprised by this snub, which left him in climate paria territory with the leaders of Saudi Arabia, Brazil, and Russia. If he was surprised, he shouldn't have been. The invitation to this summit made clear that only leaders offering substantial new commitments would be given a slot, and Morrison had merely flagged that Australia may not follow through on a widely condemned plan to use carbon accounting slate of hand to meet national emission targets. And from this latest study, it's very clear that Australia needs to come together and create more aggressive goals if they're planning on following through with this new Paris climate agreement. We've also talked about them, I think it was 2 weeks ago, and how they were trying to begin this alignment. So hopefully we have some positive updates to follow up on here in the future. And the last story I want to talk about today was covered by Grist. I think it's actually a very interesting story. A tiny town in the Finnish Arctic, the self-proclaimed coldest town in Finland, is bidding to host the 2032 Summer Olympics. Yes, you heard that right. Salla, a town of 3,396 people and an annual average temperature just below freezing, is competing with Jakarta, Istanbul, and Seoul to host Olympic sports like track and field, swimming, and cycling. The satirical bid, completed with a press conference and a promotional video, was announced that this week they're in collaboration with Fridays for Future, the climate advocacy organization founded by Greta Thunberg. With this said, that completes this segment. I will talk to you guys about carbon capture on the other side. I wanted to take a second to thank you for listening, and I hope that this podcast is eye-opening and helpful for you. I created a weekly newsletter, which you can find in the show notes, to create a curation of articles that I don't have a chance to talk about on the podcast, but I still think that they're going to be great topics for you to know about. These articles will specifically be about climate change and carbon neutrality, just as the podcast is. The newsletter will be written in TLDR form, or too long don't read. That way you can get a gist of what happened in the space, but I will also be linking the articles. That way you can click to see those as well. You will only get one email per week sent out every Friday, and it will contain between 3 to 5 summarized articles. That way you don't feel overwhelmed. This newsletter will be one of the easiest ways for you to stay in the know, so make sure to click in the show notes to sign up for the newsletter. Now we're moving on to segment 2, which I'm titling Carbon Capture Technology. What is it and why was it created? Carbon capture technology is somewhat of a new concept that you may or may not know and truly understand. So that's why I thought this topic would be a good one to talk about early on in this podcast's infancy, just because I think there's going to be many developments in this space, and I think it's important for us to all be on the same page going forward. In an article by Resources for the Future, they break down the meaning, use cases, process, and barriers for carbon capture. Carbon capture storage, known as CCS, is the process of capturing carbon dioxide formed during power generation and industrial processes and storing it so that it's not emitted into the atmosphere. CCS technologies have significant potential to reduce CO2 emissions in energy systems. Facilities with CCS can capture almost all of CO2 that they produce. Some are currently capturing between 90 or even 100%. Now, there are other use cases for using this technology outside of storing carbon into the ground. In some cases, capturing CO2 can be used to produce and manufacture goods in an industrial and other processes. This is known as CCUS, carbon capture utilization and storage. So now we know what it is, but why was this solution created? Vox published an article in November 2019 that does a great job explaining why. Carbon dioxide is a commodity with some value. It has been used both directly and as a feedstock by a range of industries, and it has been used for over a century. Most CO2 is used by industries today as a byproduct of fossil fuel processes, often from natural gas or coal-fueled plants making ammonia. That is, it comes from below the Earth's surface. Just like burning fossil fuels, it transfers CO2 from the geosphere to the atmosphere. But if CO2 is pulled out of the air, becoming more plentiful and cheaper, it could begin to become competing with terrestrial CO2. In theory, any industry that uses carbon from under the ground for fuel, beverages, directly in industrial processes, as a feedback to create other products, or whatever, could switch to the air-captured CO2. And using CO2 from the air for products and services is known as carbon capture utilization, CCU. By some estimates, it's potentially a $1 trillion market by 2030, and it could have two broad benefits. First, it could reduce CO2 emissions in part by sequestering some carbon permanently in durable products, and in part by substituting for carbon-intensive processes, thus avoiding emissions that would have otherwise occurred. But just to be clear, CCU will never reduce enough CO2 to avoid the need for CCS, aka burying carbon. The tonnage of CO2 that humanity emits simply dwarfs the tonnage of carbon-based products that it can consume. But CCU could be a helpful tool in the decarbonization tool belt. As one recent paper put it, each atom of C we can recycle is an atom of fossil fuel carbon left in the underground for next generations that will not reach the atmosphere today. By one optimistic estimate, CCU could reduce up to 10% of total global emissions by 2030. And the second benefit is the demand for CO2 driven by CCU could provide early market pull, helping to create carbon capture technology scaled up and its costs pushed down, so that it's ready when policymakers are finally able to get around to supporting CCS in earnest. Basically, it could serve as an on-ramp to CCS. So how exactly does it work? Deploying CCS at a power plant or an industrial facility generally entails 3 major steps: capture, transportation, and storage. Several different technologies can be used to capture CO2 at the source. They fall into 3 categories: post-combustion carbon capture, the primary method used in existing power plants; pre-combustion carbon capture, largely used in industrial processes; and oxy-fuel combustion systems. For post-combustion carbon capture, CO2 is separated from the exhaust of a combustion process. There are commercially available pre-combustion capture technologies used by industrial facilities. However, for power plants, pre-combustion capture is still in the early stages. This technology involves gasifying fuel and separating out the CO2. It may be less costly than other options. However, it can be built into the new facilities to retrofit an existing facility for pre-combustion capture, which would be prohibitively costly. For oxy-fuel combustion, fuel is burned in a nearly pure oxygen environment rather than regular air, which results in more of a concentrated stream of CO2 emissions, which is easier to capture. Once the CO2 is captured, it moves on to the next step in the process where it's compressed into a fluid and transported to an appropriate storage site, usually by pipelines and/or ships and occasionally by trains or vehicles. Finally, the third step, the CO2 is injected into deep underground geological formations where it's stored long-term rather than being released into the atmosphere. Storage sites used for CO2 include former oil and gas reservoirs, deep saline formations, and coal beds. And so now let's talk about what are some of the main barriers for deploying carbon capture. Well, first is the cost of implementation. Although costs are varied widely, the greatest costs are typically associated with the equipment and energy needed to capture the carbon compression phases. Capturing CO2 can decrease plants' efficiency and increase the water use, and use the additional costs posed by these other factors and ultimately render a CCS project financially non-viable. Additionally, since CCS deployment is in its early stages, financial returns on a CCS project are riskier than normal operations. Consequently, investors impose a higher risk in premiums, which further increase the private cost of the necessary capital. Mitigating risk for investors is vital for incentivizing and investing development of CCS. In order to realize full-scale deployment, additional research and development is required to optimize technology design and integration. And currently, the Department of Energy's carbon capture program is exploring these issues. Now, the next barrier is transportation challenges. In addition to high costs of carbon technology, there are other challenges associated with transporting CO2 once it's been captured. Transportation is costly. Significant energy is required to compress CO2 and maintain higher pressure throughout pipelines, and the pipelines themselves are expensive. In order to safely carry these condensed, highly pressurized CO2 pipelines, they must be specially designed. Existing oil and gas pipelines can't be used. Impurities in the CO2 stream, including water, can cause damage to pipelines, and it can lead to dangerous leaks and explosions as caused through compressed fluid rapidly expanding to a gas. Finally, each source of CO2 must be connected to an appropriate storage site via a pipeline, which can make CCS more difficult and expensive to implement in areas without geological formations that are appropriate to use for storage. And this leads me to the third barrier, which is storage considerations. The availability of geological storage is generally not considered a barrier to widespread CCS deployment, at least not in terms of the short to medium term. Indeed, there are plenty of storage worldwide for the next century, including specifically in the U.S. But some researchers have expressed some concerns about the long-term ability to storage sites to sequester carbon without significant leakage. A 2019 IPCC report concludes that current evaluation has identified a number of processes that alone or in combination can result in a very long-term storage. There's also some potential for seismic activity caused by underground injection of CO2, and researchers continue to look at ways to minimize that risk, including considering above-ground carbon dioxide mineralization as an alternative to an underground storage. The fourth barrier is uncertain public support. Public support is increasingly recognized as critical to the widespread implementation of CCS. However, it's not well known how the public currently perceives this technology. Several considerations play a role in the public opinion about CCS: acceptance of fossil fuels, acceptance of pipeline construction, perceived safety of transportation and storage of CO2, perceived effectiveness of CCS, the extent to which other climate solutions are implemented in addition to CCS, and several other considerations that can shape an individual's view of CCS and therefore overarching the public opinion. Further research is needed to better understand how the public thinks about and would react to the substantial deployment of CCS. And in the first key barrier, we kind of touched on how much energy is required to basically suck out the CO2 from the atmosphere, but I want to kind of touch on that again. In an article by Carbon Brief written in July 2019, they talk about this solution and how it could use a quarter of global energy by 2100. The research published today in Nature Communications is the first to explore the use of direct air capture, known as DAC, in multiple computer models. It shows that a massive and energy-intensive rollout of the technology could cut the cost of limiting warming to 1.5 or 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. But the study also highlights clear risks of assuming that DAC will be available at scale, with global temperature goals being breached up by 0.8 degrees Celsius if the technology then fails to deliver. And this means that policymakers should not see DAC as a way to immediately replace efforts to cut emissions. The risks are just too high. DAC should rather be seen as a backstop for challenging abatement where cutting emissions is too complex or too costly. And they warn that we should continually push back on the magic bullet headlines that DAC could become. Now, I want to continue to pick up on this magic bullet headline comment in the next segment, where we're going to be talking about the feasibility of carbon capture technology. That said, let's get a word from our sponsor from this episode. This episode is brought to you by 1% for the Planet. At 1% for the Planet, they state their purpose plainly. They exist to ensure that our planet and our future generations thrive. However, achieving this goal requires a multifaceted approach that addresses both environmental and social justice issues. They've outlined a list of nonprofit organizations that work at the pivotal intersection of race and the environment. And they also make it very easy to identify brands that share this same passion. So what does it mean to be 1% for the Planet? Well, they offer two different types of memberships, business and individual. You can enroll your business or yourself to join by donating 1% of your revenue or your salary to the approved nonprofits via monetary donations or volunteer support. Individual members will have the chance to belong to a diverse and powerful global network that supports a full spectrum of environmental solutions. Additionally, I highly encourage you to check out their company directory to learn more about who is investing their 1% and making a difference today. And you can also find nonprofits. They have a separate directory for nonprofits. Get involved for free by supporting 1% for the Planet businesses and join the movement by becoming an individual member by clicking the link in the show notes. Now, let's get back into the episode. Now, before we talk about feasibility and carbon capture being a magic bullet, last week we talked about how trees are sort of a carbon capture technology in their own right, and I think it should be highlighted in this episode. The Guardian breaks down the benefits of planting trees. Keep in mind, trees do require lots of land and water, but there is definitely a need and desire for them. Planting billions of trees across the world is one of the biggest and cheapest ways of taking CO2 out of the atmosphere to tackle the climate crisis. And this is according to scientists who have made the first calculation of how many more trees could be planted without encroaching on cropland or urban areas. As trees grow, they absorb and store the carbon dioxide emissions that are driving global heating. New research estimates that a worldwide planting program could remove 2/3 of all emissions from human activities that remain in the atmosphere today, a figure that scientists describe as mind-blowing. And if you think about it, that really is mind-blowing. 2/3 of CO2 could be removed by planting trees. Think about that. This new quantitative evaluation shows that forest restoration isn't just one of the climate change solutions. It's overwhelmingly the top one, said Professor Tom Crother at the Swiss University ETH Zurich, who led the research. Crother goes on to say, "What blows my mind is the scale. I thought restoration would be in the top 10, but it's overwhelmingly more powerful than any of the other climate change solutions proposed." He goes on to say the most effective projects are doing restoration for 30 US cents a tree. That means we could restore 1 trillion trees for $300 billion, which is 240 billion pounds. Though obviously that means immense efficiency and effectiveness, but it is by far the cheapest solution that has ever been proposed. He said that financial incentives to landowners for tree planting are the only way that he sees it happening, but he thinks that $300 billion would be within reach of a coalition or of billionaire philanthropists in the public. I'm going to take a quick side note here. I've said that I think that in the last episode that, you know, it would be more of a supplement if we did, offsets and even to an extent, I think, tree planting. But perhaps this study is telling us something that it could be more than just a supplement. I don't know. I'm not fully changing my mind on this, but it is very interesting to kind of hear and read this. As I was doing my research, I just found this very interesting. Effective tree planting could take place across the world. The potential is literally everywhere. It's the entire globe. And in terms of carbon capture, you get by far the biggest bang for your buck in the tropics, where canopy cover is 100%, but every one of us can get involved. The world's biggest nations like Russia, Canada, China, the US, Brazil, and Australia contain half of the potential restoration sites. So in summary, trees can carbon capture everywhere and cost effectively, which makes it very feasible. And all over the world, I think everybody can get involved and it can be super important as to reduce these carbon emissions. And as we were discussing earlier, carbon capture is very cost and energy intensive. So how feasible is it? And is it the best solution out there? Let's go ahead and talk about this. Well, Green Tech Media wrote an article titled Carbon Capture, Silver Bullet or Mirage? Carbon capture's prospects are brighter than ever, but carbon pricing remains a major hurdle. So let's talk about this article a little further. It says that prospects for carbon capture received a boost in September when the International Energy Agency said that the emerging technology is critical to a clean energy transition. But experts consulted by Green Tech Media have acknowledged that there is a scant likelihood of scaling carbon capture technologies to a meaningful levels without radical increase in carbon pricing around the world. The Global CCS Institute's facility database lists just 21 large-scale carbon capture plants operating in the world today. The IEA said plans for more than 30 commercial facilities have been announced in the last 3 years, but that's hardly going to stop climate change. The slow rate of progress with carbon capture was underscored in August when three companies, direct air capture firm Climeworks, technology developer CarbFix, and Icelandic geothermal asset owner OnPower, announced what they said was a groundbreaking deal. The companies claimed that they would significantly scale up carbon removal with a new plant capable of capturing 4,000 tons of atmospheric carbon dioxide a year. For comparison, fossil fuels emitted 36.7 billion tons of CO2 last year. For carbon capture to take off in a meaningful way, companies will still need to have a clear financial incentive. That means having carbon pricing comfortably above the cost of capture, usage, and/or storage. And the cost depends on where the carbon is coming from. In natural gas operations, for example, today's technology could remove around 450 million tons of carbon worldwide a year, and that costs roughly $20 per ton. But to remove carbon from difficult-to-abate industrial processes, such as the manufacturing of steel or cement, an important target for CCS and CCUS would cost more likely $100 a ton. Economies of scale could reduce that figure significantly, but it's not likely that it's going to come down to $20 a ton. That's not great news for carbon capture as things stand today. Of the fewer than 40 global carbon pricing initiatives listed on the World Bank's dashboard, only three outside of Europe show prices above $20 a ton. And only one scheme in the world, in Sweden, prices a ton above $100. Clearly, policymakers around the world are going to have to push for a much higher cost in carbon prices before CCS and CCUS become commercially viable. How likely is it that they will? The answer is still unclear. Last year, the World Energy Council included the prospects for CCUS growth in three long-term scenarios. In one, dubbed Unfinished Symphony, coordinated long-term planning and united global action helped CCUS gain traction for decarbonizing industrial processes from 2030. But it still fails to make a dent into the energy sector because it will be applied to no more than 1.2% of global power generation capacity. And that's the most optimistic scenario. In a second model called Modern Jazz, market-led forces results in more uneven economic growth, and the scale-up of CCUS doesn't happen until around 2050, likely too late to meet climate targets. And in a third scenario characterized by less global cooperation, CCUS never achieved mass adoption. Despite these sobering models, the World Energy Council remains bullish on CCUS. In the next 10 years, disruption and innovation are going to come from the demand side, which is going to shape supply-side economics and choices in a different way. But despite the World Energy Council's optimism, other observers remain cautious about the future for carbon capture. European energy researcher Schalk Kloot said that if policymakers were to adopt that kind of carbon pricing strategies that the IEA believes are needed to keep warming within 1.7 degrees of current levels, we'll likely see lots of CCS. On the other hand, if it stays like it's in the stated policy scenario, there will be quite little. The biggest uncertainty is related to policy. In summary, if politicians get serious about the 1.5-degree to 2-degree world, CCS will do its part. If this does not happen, it will be slow going. So in essence, if we want this to actually work and be the silver bullet that some suggest, we need the supporting cast of politicians to push their countries and local government to achieve these local and global goals. On the other side, I'm going to give you my final thoughts on carbon capture, and we will conclude the episode. Hello, is anybody out there? I want you to be a part of the community that we're building here on the Carbon Neutral Podcast. There's nothing like connecting with like-minded people, and especially in a time where human contact isn't exactly common. The link for the Discord invite is in the show notes. In this group, we're going to have a discussion forum, and we're going to create many other threads based on your interests and your desire to be a part of it all. Signing up is free, and it only takes a few minutes. I look forward to seeing you on the other side. So we covered a ton on today's episode. Last week, when we talked about carbon offsets, I gave you all my opinion on the matter, and I think I prefer this format on the show where I really get into the research first, and then at the end, I'm going to give you my personal thoughts. So, is carbon capture feasible, and can we rely on it in the future? Well, my personal opinion, the way I do things is I tend to evaluate solutions by starting with the cons of an implementation, and there's no denying the cost and energy that would be required. And in some ways, this technology isn't feasible for many parts of the world, but perhaps this isn't enough of a reason for us to just completely stop production and trying to make this work. We clearly have the ability today to run financial models for different use cases or processes in order for us to make the right decision for whether we need to implement CCU compared to the alternative. Where I think we need to be cautious is making sure that we have the accountability for these studies and navigate through ulterior motives that could come from proving out the need for CCU. Similarly to carbon offsets, I could see how carbon capture could be used as some way to sort of overshadow the climate issues a company might be creating. We need to make sure that abuse isn't happening, especially when we have such large cons, mainly the energy and the cost. I think we need to continue to move quickly with research and act diligently with implementation. I really hope you found this episode valuable in covering this topic today. Today's challenge for the episode, go plant trees. There are many ways that you can do this, and I'm going to link Plant Your Change in the show notes, which is a tool provided by Aspiration that rounds up your savings to plant trees. And speaking of Aspiration, next week we're going to be talking about banks. If you didn't know, I'm using Aspiration as my new bank. So, how is your bank and your money being used to fight or cause climate change? That's what we're going to be talking about next week. This episode may be eye-opening for you guys, so you'll definitely want to subscribe. And if you haven't already, make sure to give this podcast a 5-star review. This is the easiest way for you to plant a tree because all 5 stars plant a tree. Thank you so much for listening, and I will talk to you all next week.